Good evening, everyone. My name's Mickey, and I'm a real alcoholic. And I'm from Bryan, Texas, where the men are men and the sheep run scared. And the women are cunning, baffling, and powerful. And I am honored and privileged to be here at your Al-Anon conference. It is deeply a privilege for me. This is my second Al-Anon conference to attend. I guess I'm getting well. I want to thank Stephanie and the committee for inviting me here. It is, as I've mentioned, it is a privilege for me to be here, a great honor. I just absolutely love listening to Laura sing. I had the privilege of being on the program with her in Oregon not too long ago. My daughter was with me at that conference and was deeply moved by Laura sing's message. My daughter is 23, and Laura sing, you touched her greatly, and I appreciate that so much. My daughter is absolutely the joy of my life, and we have a wonderful, wonderful relationship and because of this program. And I'll touch a little more on that later. But, you know, this program is so great because we have many, many people that touch the lives of our family members, and they are so enhanced by so many heroes that come through our lives in this fellowship. And I have a lot of heroes in this fellowship. Marcine's one of them. Thank you so much. It's been a wonderful time ever since I got on the plane and left Texas this morning. I want to thank Donna and Pam for picking me up. Pam's been great ever since Stephanie invited me to come up here. She's been calling and making sure I had everything I needed. She's been calling, and Pam and Donna picked me up. Donna's her sponsor, and they picked me up from the airport this morning and started me off. And Pam said, you know, I haven't listened to your tape. I need to find out a little bit about you to introduce you. And Donna, her sponsor, says, yeah, you've heard her story before. We went and attended the conference in Augusta a couple of years ago, and you heard her talk. And Pam said, yeah, I remember going to the conference, but I didn't hear her talk. And Donna said, yeah, you heard her story. You heard her talk. And Pam couldn't remember hearing me talk. She was able to remember what she ate, but she couldn't remember my talk. I was wounded deeply. So I'm making sure that she won't forget me this weekend. So she's been sucking up greatly all day. Anyway, it is a privilege and an honor for me to be here. You know, I love Al-Anon, and I have grown to love you guys greatly. I have learned so much from the Al-Anon program and have attended Al-Anon during the course of my sobriety. I've been sober. In Texas, we give our sobriety dates, and I've been sober since February 5th of 1987, and that's truly a miracle and by God's grace. And during the course of that time, I have attended Al-Anon, and I have learned so much from the Al-Anon women. And it is because of the women in Alcoholics Anonymous and the Al-Anon women that I walk with the grace and dignity of a sober woman alcoholic today. And I am so privileged to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous today. You know, I came from an alcoholic home, and listening to Larsine, Larsine's father was my father. I was raised in a very abusive alcoholic home, and my father was a raging, roaring alcoholic army man, and he was very abusive when he drank, and there was a lot of violence in that home. And I remember times, as Larsine was describing her father, I remember times when my father would beat my mother severely, and he had been in a blackout, and he would wake up to come to the next morning and walk in the kitchen, and my mother's face would be black and blue, and he'd say, what the hell happened to you? And do you think my mother believed him? No. How could she? And we didn't understand alcoholism. We didn't know that he couldn't remember what happened. And I know that when I was about 10 or 11 years old, no more abuse could be stood in the home, and my mother asked my told my father, "You either quit drinking or leave." And my father left. And my mother thought, and as well as myself and my sister thought, my father chose alcohol over his family. It wasn't until I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and learned about the disease of alcoholism, and what I choose to believe today is that my father didn't leave because he didn't love us. I believe today that my father left because he did love us. I believe that my father knew he could not quit drinking, and he left because it was the only kind and loving thing he could do. And I did not understand the disease of alcoholism, nor did anyone. And I believe that that was the only choice he did have at that time. I don't know if he ever had the opportunity to find Alcoholics Anonymous. I know he died many, many years later from a violent death due to active alcoholism. And he died alone and a very painful death. My mother suffered greatly and still does suffer from the disease of alcoholism. My mother doesn't understand, and my mother still feels responsible for my alcoholism. Although no matter how much I try to explain to her that even if she had been able to stay at home and be a dutiful mother to me, that all she would have been able to do is watch, you know, that there was really nothing that she could do to control or cure or anything that she could do to abate in the disease, she still feels some guilt and some responsibility. But it's a lot better than what it was. But none of us back then understood what was going on. I know today, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and got to the 11th step, I know today my solution came in the 11th step prayer when it says, "Lord, help me to understand rather than be understood." And I know without a doubt that my parents, both of my parents, gave me everything they had to give. The problem is that both of them didn't have, either one of them didn't have a whole lot themselves. And I was free from my past. And you know, not even God can change the past. Not even God. But the steps allowed me to put the past in the past and go forth on a future. I didn't start drinking until I was 12. That's kind of late nowadays. And there was a lot wrong with me before I even got to 12. You know, I started stealing as soon as I could walk, and I started lying as soon as I could talk. And I was kind of born restless, irritable, and discontent. And some of that may be due to being raised in an alcoholic home. I don't know, but I'm a child of the 60s too, and I was born a rebel, you know. I mean, it was just kind of in my blood. I was a rebel with a cause. I was a rebel without a cause. I was a rebel because. It was just kind of in my blood, you know, and blamed it on a wild heart. And I was just, you know, I was a daredevil. I had to be seen. I had to have something happening all the time. I mean, I was just quick to be bored, you know. I mean, I had to have thrill and had to be excited all the time. And I wasn't very good at getting positive attention. That was my sister. My sister was she was older, a couple of years older than I am, and she was the cheerleader and the class favorite and all that. And on Friday nights while she was out there cheering the football team on, I was the one in the parking lot stealing hubcaps, you know. I mean, I wasn't good at getting positive attention, but I'm real good at getting negative attention, and negative attention is better than no attention. And so while she was doing all the good things, I'm at the tattoo parlor getting tattoos, you know, because little girls back then didn't get tattoos, so I had to get tattoos. Now, I never got any tattoos put on my breast, because there was a reason for that. Today I tell people that my body's a work of art. And this was this was a long time ago when girls didn't get tattoos. Now everybody's getting tattoos everywhere. I might have been the one that started the trend, I don't know. I probably did, but, you know, I never had any put on my breast because of a story I heard a long time ago of a young woman who had a rosebud tattooed on her breast, And then when she turned 75, it had become a long stem rose. No matter how drunk I got, I never could get that out of my mind, you know. And so I started doing bizarre and crazy things. I started running with the fast crowd, you know, motorcycle gangs and all that kind of stuff, just running with the fast, riding fast cars and doing crazy things. And, you know, at 12 years of age, I was walking down the street with some friends of mine, and the neighbor had his garage door open, and inside the garage were these cases of long neck Miller beer. Just sitting there. This guy couldn't have been an alcoholic, because why would you have all these cases of beer in your garage in the heat of the summer, had dust and cobwebs all over them? I mean, why would you have that? I don't know, but they were in his garage, so my friends and I went in there and stole this guy's long neck Miller beer, proceeded to go down there and to my friend's house and open this beer, and proceeded to drink this hot long neck Miller beer. Well, it didn't take long for us to reach that feeling of intoxication, almost instantly followed by nausea and vomiting from drinking this hot, long-neck Miller beer. And we didn't have those skills that would come with drinking, you know, as we proceeded in our career, of sticking your finger down your throat and puking so you could go back and drink some more, or learning to coat your stomach so you could drink properly and consume more, or putting one foot on the floor to keep the room from spinning. You know, those things would come with time and, you know, experience. So we somehow got into my friend's house after throwing up from drinking his hot beer and got into the bed and finally passed out and got up the next morning with that green complexion. Some of you Al-Anons have seen your husbands have, or loved ones. And got up the next morning just really, really sick. And my friend looked at me and said, "My God, Mickey, I'm never doing that again." And she was serious. And I never remember seeing her for the rest of our years in junior high and high school. I never remember seeing her tie one on ever again. She saw what the problem was and made the correction, and she never did it again. And I remember looking at her that same morning with the same sickness and saying, "You're absolutely right. I'm never doing that again either." And I never did. I never drank hot Miller beer again. Because something happened differently for me than it did for her. That brief period of intoxication did something for me that it didn't do for her. That brief period of intoxication quieted all that insanity, quieted all that restlessness and irritability. It made that all go away. What it talks about in the big book, that sense of ease and comfort that came at once by taking a few drinks, happened for me that didn't happen for her. It quieted all, it made that madness go away. It made me okay in my own skin for the first time at the age of 12. It was like magic, even for a brief period of time. Even though I puked my toenails up, I was okay for just a little while. And what I know happened to me, because the steps allowed me to go back and look at that, what happened to me at the age of 12 was a solution that I'd look for the rest of my life. When I tell you, when I stand up here and tell you that my name's Mickey and I'm a real alcoholic, what that means for me, being an alcoholic, my problem is not really alcohol. What my problem is living life sober. Sober for me is painful. Sober for me is restless, irritable, and discontent. Sober for me is boring and depressing, and life sucks. It stinks. It is not fun. It does not feel good. Sober, the state of being sober is not pleasurable. It is not good. I don't like it, and I will do whatever I can to alter that, because it just doesn't feel good. And for the next 20 years of my life, I would do whatever I could to once again experience that sense of ease and comfort that comes by taking a few drinks. And if I could have done it by just taking a few drinks, that would be okay. But what happens is I have this illness. And when I take that first few drinks, it demands I take more and more. And I can never get that equation just right. I will overshoot that mark because I have this allergy to alcohol that demands I take more and more and more and more. And I just can't get it right. I just can't get it right. I started being a blackout drinker almost immediately. I started drinking and I started waking up in places that I don't know how I got there. I don't know anything about social drinking. You know, I'm a child of the 60s. The only thing I ever did socially was spread a little VD. And I only did that a little bit. Not much, just a little bit. And I started blacking out and coming to in places and not knowing how I got there. I started blacking out and coming to in jail and not knowing how I got there. And that ended up becoming a pattern for me. At the age of 14, I found better living through chemistry. I started smoking those funny cigarettes and started taking these strange pills, either prescription pills that didn't have my name on the label, and taking these black market pills. Was not uncommon to find me out in a cow pasture after a heavy rain, you know. Because today when I tell you I'm an alcoholic, and it talks about it in the big book, I will do anything to alter the way I feel. Anything. I'm addicted to a feeling of intoxication, and for me that came in a lot of different forms. So I start drinking and I start doing all these other bizarre and crazy things. But alcohol has always been a reliable source for me. And I would end up in jail and I kept doing all these crazy things. You know, I'm so grateful for the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous that has again allowed me to go through and make some sense out of the things that I have done and what I was really looking for when I did those things. Not only my motivation behind why I did the things I did and what it was that I really wanted when I did those things. You know, some of the things that I know in my life is that I always wanted to be loved. I think we all do. To love and to be loved is the goal of all human beings. And I wanted that all my life. But when you grow up in an alcoholic home, we have a real twisted idea of what love is. At the age of 16, not knowing what love was and wanting desperately to be loved and to feel special and needed and wanted, and not knowing how to get that or give that, I traded all that for sex. And you know, I see so many of us who still do that today. I see a lot of that going on in meetings and people coming in the program, young in sobriety, wanting to feel loved and wanting to be loved, and we're still trading that for sex. Watch out. Watch out. Take time when you're young in recovery to find out what love is. But at 16, I was looking for love in all the wrong places. And I found myself pregnant and not knowing what to do. I went to Austin, Texas and had an illegitimate child that I gave up for adoption and came back to small town Texas scorned. You know, today if you're 16 and pregnant, it's not a really big deal. But in 1972 in small town Texas, that was a big deal. I had a scarlet letter, felt like it was tattooed on my forehead, and we didn't have any way to deal with that kind of pain. I didn't have any way to deal with that kind of pain except to drink. And I stayed drunk on that for a long, long time. That was a big excuse for me to drink. Alcohol gave me the ability to hold my head up and say, I don't care what society thinks. I don't care. Without alcohol, I could not walk out of my house. At 16 years of age, I needed and depended on alcohol to get me through, to walk out the front door. And you know, looking back, again, the 12 steps gives me the ability to look back on that. You know, society didn't do anything to me. What I see now is I would walk out on the street, and if you looked at me, if somebody looked at me, it wasn't what they said or what they did. I shamed myself to the pit of hell for what I had done. I did that to me, not what anybody else did. And my solution to that was, I've got to get out of Hearne, Texas. I've got to get out of Texas. Texas had become my problem. So I moved 500 miles away as soon as I graduated high school. I'm getting out of here, man, with the good intentions to start over. So I made a geographical change at 17 years of age to move far, far away, start over. I'm going to go somewhere where no one knows my sordid past and things are going to be different. I'm going to get a career. I'm going to get a good job. I'll find me a good man. I'll get married. I'll have children to replace that child I gave up for adoption. And things are going to be good. Things are going to be different. And so I moved 500 miles away to a small town right outside of New Orleans, Louisiana, where people party 24/7, and that was not a good move. I was there 2 weeks before I ended up in jail wondering, how did this happen? You know, but I didn't change anything. I mean, I didn't change a thing. I moved down there and continued to do the exact same thing I was doing in small town Texas, drinking and partying. And of course, the same thing that happened to me in Texas happened to me in Louisiana. I ended up in jail. But you know, again, I felt I was being punished for what I had done. And the circumstances continued in Louisiana. So what I ended up doing was, I did end up getting married. I married the guy I got arrested with, so he couldn't testify against me and I couldn't testify against him. That's that keen alcoholic thinking I think y'all talk about in Al-Anon, isn't it? And so we took in sick together, and I got pregnant immediately on purpose because I wanted to fill that hole. I wanted to fill that hole. I thought that was the solution. But you know, you can't replace a child with another child. And I had to keep drinking to try to fill that void. I never did fill that void until I got into... I didn't fill the void of that first child I gave up for adoption until I got into Alcoholics Anonymous. And the way I did that was to make amends to that child that I gave up for adoption, which was to leave those people alone. And that was real tough to do, but that was after I got sober and into Alcoholics Anonymous. And to learn to let that deal go, and that was God's deal. And but I have these two children now, and I want desperately to be a wife, and I want desperately to be a mother. But alcoholism ruled that home. And wanting to be a good mother and wanting to be a good wife was not enough. And being an alcoholic would not allow me to do those things. You know, I love my children more than I love my own life. There's not a day that has ever gone by since the birth of those children that if someone came to me and said, your life or your children, that I would not never have to even think, take my life. And I'm sure you feel that same way about your children if you're a parent. I don't believe that there's anything stronger than a mother's love for her child except alcoholism. Because alcoholism took me from my children on a regular basis. I love my children so much, and I wanted nothing more than to be a good mother to those children. But alcoholism controlled my life. I moved back to Texas in 1980, and I like to say moved because it sounds better than unlawful flight to avoid prosecution. As my alcoholism progressed, so did my illegal activities. And by the time I moved back to Texas, I had made a lot of other really poor decisions. And one of those was, one night under the influence of alcohol, I had let a friend put a needle in my arm. And when I came back to Texas, I was putting needles in my arms, involved in serious illegal activity. And I fled the law and moved back to Texas. And, you know, I was raised with a lot of ideas that became fact for me. And one of those along the line, and I don't know where I heard it or where it became real for me, but one of those I was raised with was, you made your bed, now lie in it. And some of you may have heard that principle. That principle ruled my life for most of my life. And when I became that junkie, I made my bed and I lied in it. I knew what happened to people like me. I saw every day what happened to people like me. And it was nothing good. People like me ended up in dumpsters. People like me were shot by police. People like me went to prison for long terms. People like me died from overdoses. People like me were shot by other people like me. You know, bad things happened to people like me. People like me were not successful. People like me survived as long as we could survive until we died. And that was it. I made my bed and I was going to lie in it. And I was going to just survive just as long as I could until I died. And I accepted that fate. I accepted it wholeheartedly. And therefore I did nothing to try to change it. No one taught me until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. No one told me how to change the sheets until I came to you. I came back to Texas, accepted my fate, and I was fighting to survive. And My marriage would dissolve, of course, because I couldn't be a wife. I didn't know how, and I've got these two children. And I wanted desperately to try to be some kind of mother, and I was not a very good mother. I'm one of those mothers that would go to the store for a loaf of bread, fully intending to go to the store for a loaf of bread and not come back for 3 days. And I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to be this kind of person. And I would come home and I would be so sick and hungover and tore down after this hard run I had been on. And I would have these beautiful, beautiful, blonde-haired, gold-eyed children who would be cleaning their mama up with the washcloth. And these children would tell me the truth. These little children would tell their mama the truth. They would say, you know, mama, if you didn't drink, you wouldn't get sick. And they would be cleaning me up. And I would look at these beautiful, blonde-haired, gold-eyed children, and I would look at them, and I would be full of so much guilt and remorse and shame. Shame that only an alcoholic woman knows, an alcoholic mother. And I would say to them, my God, how can I do this to you? And I would say, you know, today is going to be different. I'm not going to do this anymore. And I'm, by God, I mean it this time. I said, today I'm going to stay home with you and we're going to watch a movie, or we're going to play a game, or we're going to go to the park, or we're going to go to the circus. And my soul is screaming out, I want to be your mother. I want to be with you. You know, and I'm telling you, this is it. This time I mean it. And you know, children are so resilient. They're so trusting. And they would once again, so many times, believe that this time I mean it. This time I really mean it. And they would accept this, my word, one more time. And then they would go in the other room and they would start to play, because this time mommy means it. She means it this time. We're gonna be a family. And they would go in the other room. But I have this insidious disease who doesn't care about those children or about my promises or about my intentions or about the love I have for them. And they would begin to play. And pretty soon this knot would start in my stomach, or this shake would start in my hand. And the obsession would start, the obsession of alcoholism. And it wasn't this fiend that would jump out of me that would make me run around the house like a madman. The obsession starts when I get a little bit nervous and a little bit shaky. And the obsession says, you know, Mickey, if you have one drink, it'll take that edge off and you can go be a better mom to those kids. Just one drink, Mickey. Just one. And you can go in there and be at ease with those kids. And I go and I take that one drink. And the one drink sets up that physical allergy that demands I take another. And then I have to go to the store for a loaf of bread or a gallon of milk or something. And I'm off again. And I left those children with people children didn't need to be left with. And my children have heard things that children don't need to hear. My children have seen things that children should never see. And my children have experienced things that no child should ever experience. When I was 6 years sober, my daughter came to me. And thank God that at 6 years sober, Alcoholics Anonymous had given my daughter a mother she could come to. Because my daughter had begun to date a young man, and they had begun an intimate relationship. But my daughter had begun to have problems in the intimate area as a young adult. And the reason she was having problems in the intimate area of relationships is because between the ages of 4 and 8 years old, my daughter would be repeatedly raped by the neighborhood 15-year-old boys because I was not there to protect my baby. And when she told me that at 6 years sober, I thought I would literally die. How do you make amends for that? How do you make amends for that? You know, with her permission, I share that from the podium. It is part of her healing that she allows me to share that. Part of her story, because that's part of our story. It's part of our healing that we get to share that. Because part of our tragedy has become part of our healing. In that, that has brought us closer together as a mother and daughter. Because forgiveness and love is more powerful than what this disease can tear apart. All I can say is thank God I don't get what I deserve. At 6 years sober, I thought I would die. I wanted to find these kids and kill them, what they did to my baby. And I went to my elders in Alcoholics Anonymous and got the instruction I needed to get my daughter the professional help she needed. Thank God my daughter had a mother at 6 years sober she could go to, and we got her the professional help she needed. Thank God my daughter didn't have to carry that with her for years and years and years and go through years and years of failed relationship after failed relationship, or possibly never get help for that. I just know that if you ever experience such a thing in your life, you will understand the mercy of a loving God. We talk about the grace in here of a loving God. I can tell you about the mercy of a loving God and what forgiveness can do in the family. Larsine can attest to our relationship, and that is an amazing young woman in my life. And she is healed from that. And we have grown closer together as a mother and daughter. And the trust we have for each other is incredible. Thank God I didn't get what I deserve. You know, if you're paranoid and you think they're out to get you, they are. And in 1986, while I was doing my deal, I was arrested for a first-degree felony punishable by up to 99 years in the penitentiary. And I thought, man, these guys are really getting serious. And I was always able to rationalize what I was doing, you know. I mean, I wasn't really being that bad. I was just hanging out with my friends, my buddies, my pals, my compadres. But in Texas, they call that organized crime. And they were not very thrilled about my behavior. And I spent a lot of time in jail that year. And somewhere along the line, someone told me about going to Alcoholics Anonymous. They said, you know, if you go to Alcoholics Anonymous, it looks good when you go to court. So I was pretty willing to go to any length at that time to look good when I went to court. And decided I would go check out Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to my first AA meeting. I ended up having to go back to jail. Got in trouble when I was in trouble. I don't know if we got any of those people here. That's not a whole lot of fun. That's one of the times when you go to jail and you can't get out. But, you know, I always found God when I went to jail. It's easy to find God when you go to jail. I would go and I would kneel by that cot when nobody was looking, of course, and I could kneel by that cot and it was like I had this invisible cell phone and whip it out and dial 911 God, you know? And it was always that same old prayer I always had, you know, God, get me out of this one. I'll never do it again. And you mean that prayer because you wouldn't actually lie right out to God because you know God can hear you. I've always believed in God, but I never acted like I believed in God. And I would always say that prayer, get me out of this one, I'll never do it again. And I really meant that. I never wanted to do it again. But you know, I would stay in jail for however long it took in jail. I love Johnny H. from California when he said, it doesn't take a genius to get out of jail, it just takes time. And I would do however long of time it took for me to get out of jail, and they would call my name, and I would get out of jail, and as soon as I walked out of jail, I left God locked up in jail. Because until I found Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't know how to take God with me. I did not know how to take a loving God with me into my daily life. I absolutely had no personal relationship with a kind and loving God to allow Him to direct my life on a daily basis. All I knew was how to call on God when I was in a jam and beg Him to get me out of it. I did not know how to have a personal relationship with a God. So all I did was call on Him when I was in a jam, and He always forsaked me because He never performed magic. And so I would do that. And I left Him locked up in jail, and I would walk out and go back to self-will run riot and do my own deal because I didn't know any other way. So here I am. Somebody talked about AA would look good when you went to court, so I walked into my first AA meeting. So I go into this conservative AA meeting in Bryan, Texas, and I walk in there, and everybody gets so excited when they have a newcomer come there. I guess they hadn't had a newcomer in a century, you know. And so I walk into this newcomer meeting, and everybody gets so excited. They come up, and they introduce themselves, and they say, oh, you're the most important person here. And I said, well, hell, I know that, you know. I mean, it was not any news to me that I was the most important person there. Obviously, I'm facing up to 99 years, you know. So they begin to explain to me what it was like for them and what happened and what it's like now. And this guy starts talking to me about how his drinking had gotten so bad that his wife left him. And the pain of that was so great that he went to AA and put the plug in the jug and his life got better and his wife came back and ain't life grand. And I'm thinking to myself, my God, what a wimp, you know? One wife, one time, you know? I said, buddy, I know a lot of women that'll drink with you, you know? Come on.
But what this man was talking about was truly loving his wife. And you know, and I mean, I was so far removed from any of that stuff. I mean, it made absolutely no sense to me. I didn't understand why he couldn't find a woman to party with, you know. And so it made absolutely no sense to me. And so then this other woman starts talking about how she has worked so hard at this part-time minimum wage job and saved up money for 10 years to buy some little used vehicle. And I am so, once again, I have been leading this life of illegal activity, and she's talking about honest living and working, you know, and I am so far removed from any of this kind of goody-two-shoe stuff that I do not hear what message she's trying to give. And I do not hear the music of AA at this point in time. And I don't hear what she's trying to say either. And so what I deduce from that is that I am too bad for Alcoholics Anonymous and that these people are just too simpleton for me. And I'm just too bad and I don't hear what they're trying to say and that this possibly cannot work for me. And so I leave that meeting and say, you know, this might be good for y'all simple people, but it's not going to help me at all. And I go back and I continue to do what it is that I'm doing. And so I go to this, I go to court and they offer me this plea bargain of 20 years in the penitentiary, which I am not happy with either. And I decide to go to a trial by jury. And they said it was a jury of my peers, but I promise you there wasn't anybody there I would have hung out with. I didn't see any of my buddies there. To make a long story short, it was a horrible process, and I ended up taking the stand in my own defense, and I did not tell the truth. And I was found guilty of this first-degree felony. Now, I did not tell the truth, and somehow, I don't know, it was really had to be an act of God. This jury decided to give me another opportunity, one more chance. And I was given one of the strictest probated sentences in our county. Now, I was angry at this sentence. I did not want probation. But they gave me one of the most intense supervision probations that's ever been handed down in our county. 10 years intense supervision probation. And I was angry. I was furious. How dare they do this to me? The bottom line is I knew I would never be able to do it. But I was angry because no one was going to tell me how to run my life. No one was going to tell me how to run my life. Now, by this time, I had been arrested and I had lost everything that I owned. I was living in an abandoned house. I had absolutely nothing, and I was worried about somebody telling me how to run my life. Kind of crazy, isn't it? But I was furious that someone dare tell me how to run my life. I left the courtroom that day just furious and went to make it all go away one more day. I'm still fighting. I'm a fighter and I'm still fighting. And I was not willing to surrender. And until you reach that point of surrender, nothing's going to change. No one can do a thing until you reach that point of surrender. I went back and I was in this abandoned house. And I had one person who was left in my life. A young man, his name was Bud. He was 24 years old. I always liked those younger men. I thought if you got them young, you could train them. I would do whatever I could to get these younger men. I would go to some of those lower companion places and find those young men, take them hostage. I might qualify for Al-Anon. Bring them home, do what you got to do, start that training process. You know, convince them that, you know, you can benefit them greatly. But I never knew how to do relationships either. I was really, really sick at relationships. I believed in control and power. Control and power. Y'all think I might qualify for Al-Anon? Control and power. And begin that training process. But then they do something on their own and then you got to get rid of them. But you can't get rid of them until you have another prospect, right? You always have to have one because who are you going to blame when things go wrong? And sometimes you've got one going out and one coming in. You all three meet in the middle, and boy, that's good for a weekend drunk. And then the best way to get over one is to have another one, right? Jump into another relationship. I learned in my fourth step, it was very, very interesting when I did the sexual part of my inventory, is that, you know, the best way I got over a relationship was to jump into a new one. And what I discovered was that when I jumped into that new relationship paid for what the last one did. You know, if this guy ran around on me, I was insanely jealous of the next guy for no reason. If this guy lied to me, I was untrusting of the next guy for no reason. I abused a lot of guys for no reason. You know, my amends to guys for a long time was to leave you guys alone. I mean, I really had to leave guys alone for a long time, sponsors' orders. And I've learned, too, that a relationship can only be as healthy as the two people involved. And, you know, I was a pretty sick person for a really long time in the relationship area. I did not know how to have a relationship. And I didn't learn anything about men at all until I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And it talks about them in the big book. It says they are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. I love guys. I just love them. They're wonderful. They're great. They make me laugh. They keep me happy. But I had this young man who was in my life. His name was Bud, and he was 24 years old. And Bud would be the one that would save my life. He absolutely saved my life, and I owe my life to him. Bud came to me this night in this abandoned house, and he began to point out the reality of my situation. He pointed out that I had lost my children. He pointed out that I had lost everything that I had owned. And he pointed out that I was doing the exact same thing that got me in all the trouble I was in. He pointed out that I had just been put on probation. I was doing what I was fixing to go to prison. And that I wasn't doing anything differently. And he began to ask me, what are you going to do now? And I had no answers for him. And I did whatever I could do to get him away from me. And the way I did that was with a foul mouth and a bad tongue. And I did whatever I could to slice him up and get him away from me. And as I began to just cut him up with my tongue, he finally just dropped his shoulders and he said, you know, I can't live like this anymore. And he dropped his shoulders and he started to walk off. And I cursed that young man like a dog, just cursed him like a dog. And he started to walk out, and I made that grandstand play I had made so many times before of, you go ahead and leave. I don't need you. I don't need anybody. I don't need anything. If everyone would just leave me alone, I'd be okay. And the sad part about it is I believe that. And as he walked out that door, I went back in that house to put some more of that poison in my body and make it all go away. One more night. I'll worry about it tomorrow. But right now, I need some relief. And he walked out the door, and I just made it go away. As the next morning, the sun came up, and I went outside, and I found his solution to our problems. And his body hung from a tree limb with a rope around his neck, and he was dead. Something happened to me that instant. You know, I've seen people dead all through my life from this illness, but something happened to me at that moment. A terror went through me that I have never known before. Something happened to me when I looked death in the face that morning that changed my life from that day to this. I knew I was responsible for his death, and I knew I was next. I knew those two things, and I had a moment of clarity that changed me from that day to this. I started running from that moment on. I ran and I ran and I ran and I ran. And no amount of alcohol or those other chemicals could not make that go away. Every time I took a drink, it just magnified my uselessness and my worthlessness and my responsibility for all of my problems. And I'm telling you, it drove me to a depth of insanity I thought I could never return. And when I say that young man saved my life, I truly, truly mean that. I truly mean that. I started running, and I had this truck, and I was driving in this truck. And the miracle happened for me, I began to cry one night. And a tear started, and I'm one of those tough broads. I mean, I don't cry. And a tear started, and when one tear started, it opened the floodgate for a ton of tears. And I had to pull off to the side of the road. And I know that when the tears started, that was a form of surrender for me when I started crying. And I just really broke down and just bawled like a baby. And I could not remember the last time I had cried. And I just started bawling. I mean, just bawling like a baby. I don't, just for everything. And I cried and I cried and I cried. And I know that that was a form of surrender, because when I started crying, I know that God intervened. And the way I know that God intervened is because after a little while, I sat up and I had that deja vu feeling. I knew I had been there, but I couldn't quite remember where I was. And then it finally dawned on me, I was outside that AA meeting I had been to many months before. And the miracle of it was, is it was 7:45 and people were walking in. I know my God intervened. And something beyond, that was greater than me, a power greater than myself, demanded I go in there. I knew I had to get in that AA meeting or I was going to die. I knew I was next. I knew my neck was on that rope next. And I went inside into that meeting. And I started up that sidewalk. It was cold. It was raining late January, sometime in there. And I fell down in the mud and literally crawled into what I call my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got in there, and I'd love to tell you the people of the Brian group rushed to my side with a cup of coffee and a plate of donuts and said, "Let us help you up, you poor, precious child of God." But that's not what they did in the Brian group. They came over and they said, "Are you sick and tired of being sick and tired, and have you had enough?" And I had had enough. I had had enough. And I got up and I got into that chair, and I don't know what happened for a lot of meetings after that time. I just remember that they welcomed me in there. I sat in that chair, and I remember they said, "Keep coming back." And I kept going to that meeting, and they told me where the next meeting was, and I just went to that next meeting. And they told me where the next meeting was, and I went to that next meeting. And somewhere in that insanity, I remembered I was supposed to go see this probation officer. And that was a miracle that I remembered to go see her. And I went to see this probation officer, and she said, "Can you do this by yourself?" And I said, "I don't think so." Because I went cold turkey after that night. I went to that AA meeting, and the chemicals I was putting in my body was some pretty powerful stuff. And she tried to get me into a treatment center somewhere, and there was nothing in our area. And the only thing that they had at that time was Austin State Hospital, and there was a 3-month waiting list. And I'm dying today. And the judge had ordered me to 90 meetings in 90 days. And I was still a bit rebellious, and so I said, "Well, I'll show him." So I went to one meeting a day for that judge, and I went to one meeting a day for Mickey. And pretty soon I found myself going to 3, 4, and 5 meetings a day because I got real sick. And when Alcoholics Anonymous says they can love you sober, by God, I'm living proof. I did not get to go to a detox center. I did not get to go to a treatment center. I detoxed in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm telling you, it's tough. It was tough. There were times I involuntarily threw up on myself. I shook. I vomited. My hair fell out. My skin peeled. I was in a knot most of the time and sweated and shook and all that stuff. And the people in Alcoholics Anonymous patted me on the shoulder and they said, "If you don't put any more of this stuff in your body, this too shall pass, and you never have to go through this again." And I dared to believe them. Dared to believe them. I went to see my probation officer every other day for the first 3 months. And most of that was just for, she told me later, was just to see if I was alive from one day to the next. And I don't know how I hung on. I mean, I was sick. I'm telling you, I got sick. But I guess I was too scared to die. I don't know. But the sickness passed. I mean, they didn't lie. It went away one day. It went away, and I don't know. I somehow made it through that. And then I started sitting in the back of the meetings, telling everybody how bad I was. And I started telling everybody about those times when I was big and bad and tough out on the street. And a guy named Charlie came over to me and said, "Mickey, why don't you fix your coffee and come sit up front?" And I said, "Well, they want to know what it's like out there on the street." And he said, "Yeah, come fix your coffee and sit up front." So I went and fixed my coffee and I sat up front. And he said, "Sit up here and shut up and listen." And Charlie probably saved my life. Because sitting in the back talking about how big and bad and tough I wasn't hearing anything and I wasn't learning anything. And so for the next 3 months in Alcoholics Anonymous, the only thing they let me do was read How It Works. Because there were no cuss words in How It Works. Now, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't look anything like I look today. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm 5'10". And when I came into AA, I weighed 114 pounds, and I thought I looked good. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I told you I was a tough broad. Still am, but I was real tough then. When I came in, I was wearing these skin-tight blue jeans or these black leather pants, tucked in these knee-high black leather boots with a brass tip on the end, because I'm tough. I had a big black wallet in my back pocket with this dog chain that hung down to my knees and hooked up on my belt loop because I'm bad. I had a big wad of keys over here on my hip, so it made a lot of noise when I walked. A lot of noise and a big wad of keys. Now, my truck started with a screwdriver. I'm living in an abandoned house. But I got a big wad of keys over here on my hip. I got a black leather jacket with fringe hanging down all over it because I'm cool. I wear a black t-shirt with the neck cut out and the sleeves cut out because I'm hot. I got a black hat that I wore pulled down over my eyes. I had to wear my sunglasses in the meeting because the light was just a little bit too bright. I wore these black leather gloves with the fingers cut out in them, and I'd sit in the meeting and do this. I wore this big black leather belt with these spikes sticking out on it. Don't touch me. And that's what all that was. I'd walk in, tough, stomping those boots. I mean, it was about don't touch me. When I walked in the first meeting, there's a guy, he's a good friend of mine today, he said the first time he saw me walk in the meeting, he leaned over to the guy next to him and said, "Boy, things are fixing to pick up around here." And they did. And one of the things that kept me coming back for a long time was Al-Anon. Because I used to love to go to the Brian group on Tuesday and Friday nights because they had Al-Anon meeting upstairs. Right across from the Al-Anon meeting was the closed AA meeting, and I used to love to go up there on Tuesday and Friday night to terrorize the Al-Anons. I'd start at the bottom of those stairs, and I'd start going up, and I'd start clanging up those stairs, slinging that chain, rattling those keys, and I'd round that corner, and those Al-Anons would scatter. And I'd say, "Yeah, come on, you want some of this?" "I didn't think so, because you're scared. Look at you, you measly, mouthy women." Because I hated women when I came in the program. I hated all women, but especially those Al-Anons. Why? Because they were so color-coordinated. Those Al-Anon women just made me sick. They always had those earth tone colors on. They were all so color coordinated with their little outfits on. They were always so cute, just so precious. They had those little outfits, matching little outfits with their little tops and bottoms matched. And usually their little had their little flats on, their little pumps on that matched their little handbags. They were just so cute. And they had their little makeup on, and they had their little hair fixed. Oh, they were just so cute. And they looked just like I do now. But I hated them. I hated you guys. I absolutely hated you. You were just the epitome of everything I just detested because I didn't know what it was to be a woman. Absolutely did not know what it was to be a woman. And it took me a long time to learn, and I have learned by watching you what it is to be a woman. You know, I tried for so many years to learn from men what it was to be a woman, and that is impossible. And I tell the women in Alcoholics Anonymous today, you will not learn what it is to be a woman from a man. You can't. The women in Alcoholics Anonymous will have to learn what it is to be a woman from the women in Alcoholics Anonymous and the women in Al-Anon what it is to be a woman. You can get relief from a man, but if you want recovery, you've got to get it from a woman. And I'm a big believer of that. And I would have to get a sponsor, and they were so big on you got to get a sponsor. And so I looked around the room and I said, Charlie, what about that guy over there with 30 days, you know? I bet he could keep me sober tonight. And they said, no, you got to have a woman. And I thought, well, you know, I'm hating women. What am I going to do? And so I became a chronic complainer in meetings, and I complained. And finally, this woman came up to me after a meeting one day, and she said, Mickey, I want to tell you, you're full of shit. And turned around and walked off. Well, no one talks to the most important person at the meeting like that, you know? And I went to tell her about it, and my mouth opened, and a voice like mine came out and said, will you be my sponsor? And Linda Kay turned around and looked at me from the top of my head to the tip of my toes and square in the eye and said, I don't like you, but I'll help you because I have to stay sober. And I thought, well, let me help you, you know. And Linda Kay took me to the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she said, do you have a big book? And I said, no. And she said, do you have any money? And I said, no. And she said, well, steal one. You can make amends later. So I did. So I stole my big book, and we went on, and she took me to the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous and took me through the 12 steps. She was one for going through the steps in order and progressively. Progressively. We went to and worked the steps in order and progressively. Immediately following step one, we did step two. Immediately following step two, we did third step prayer and we did step three. Immediately following the third step prayer, we launched into step four. Immediately following step four, we did step five, and so on and so on. And the way we knew that we had completed each step is because I got the results of the step, and the results are in the book. And that's how I knew I had gotten those, when I got the results of the steps, and the results are in the book. And she said, you know, you're not going to wait till you start feeling better before you do the steps. You do the steps, and then you feel better. And what I can promise you without a doubt, if you're new in the program, is that within a year, by the time I was 9 months or a year sober, I was a totally different human being. Totally different. When I got to my ninth step, you know, I was a person that I thought that I was going to have to move away from my community because I had raped my community, you know. It was bad. I had really raped my community, and I had done so much illegal activity. And I thought I was going to have to get out of there in order to get sober. And it was the old-timers that came to me and said, you will look this community in the eye and you will pay back what you have done. So I became of service in my community. I mean, I started going into my community and became a volunteer at every available opportunity in that community. And I am so grateful. I am so grateful. I got a legal job. I started out doing minimum wage stuff. I got back to school. I got some initials behind my name. I started doing volunteer work in my community, and I am so grateful. At 3.5 years, I went back before that judge. And with recommendations from people in that community, I was released from the bondage of my supervision on probation after being sentenced by a jury for 10 years, which was unheard of. But they released me off of my probation early with recommendations from people in that community. I'm so grateful. And I didn't do that to get off probation early, but that was a benefit by doing things differently, by doing things differently. And my probation officer was behind me 100% and said, here, do this other action, take some more action, and let's do this and see what happens. And I was like, whoa, what she was telling me to do, I was like, whoa, no, there's no way, man. I was convicted of a first-degree felony punishable by up to 99 years. She said, just take this action. And I took some action, and you guys will never believe that in 1994, I received a full pardon from the governor of the state of Texas and restored my full civil rights. Yeah. And you know, that's not really for me, that's really for God, because God needed that in order for me to do some of the things that I do today that I couldn't do with if I didn't have this pardon. And it's just a neat deal, but it's all about God. It's all about God. It really is. And I started, you know, having a relationship with a God of my understanding that has just been absolutely incredible. All my life, it was about, God, what can you do for me? And today, I wake up every day saying, God, what can I do for you? And I have a beautiful day every day I do that. God, what can I do to serve you? And I have a wonderful day every day I do that. And so I started doing everything I could to serve God. And things just got so wonderful and so good. And you know, I have human problems just like everybody else. But my life took on a whole new direction and a whole new meaning. When I was 5 years sober, my kids came back. They came to live with me because they wanted to. Thank God I didn't get what I deserve. Thank God I became a responsible person in society and a responsible mother because I started doing what I said I was going to do when I said I was going to do it. And I'm so grateful. This 12 steps absolutely changed my life. Changed my life incredibly. And, you know, I've been fully self-supporting through my own contributions. I mean, that's a miracle in and of itself. I learned how to be a good employee. I'm responsible. I do a full day's work for a full day's pay. And things have just been absolutely remarkable in that era. I have not had to look for a job since I've been sober. You know, and I've had a lot of jobs. I've worked in a field where I've been laid off a lot, and something keeps coming up. I was telling Pam and Don on the way up here about a recent job change and situation I've had. But I'll tell you about that in just a second. You know, we never know when we're being looked at or when we may be the only copy of the big book or a program that people will see. You know, this probation officer that I had, she's been so inspirational in my life, and that role has changed too. I got a call and was invited to this little kind of private get-together party. And to make another long story short, I gave my probation officer her one-year chip when I was 3.5 years sober, which was a really, really neat deal. And she said that because she saw what happened in my life, that she thought if it could work for me, that it could work for her. So I have 2.5 years on my probation officer, and I never let her forget it. And I don't get to share that around in the state of Texas, but she lets me share that whenever I leave the state. We never know when we are going to be a copy or who is watching us in this program, and that's a really neat deal. And so things just, you know, keep rocking and rolling. And I've been in failed relationships since I've been sober, and some of those things have been extremely painful. My sponsor was one that said no relationships for the first year. She said, and that's not 365 days. What that's about is you developing a relationship with the God of your understanding. She said, if you don't have a relationship with God, you cannot have a relationship with another human being. She said, for the first year, you'll do the three M's. You'll go to meetings, you'll meditate, and you'll masturbate. I learned a lot about myself that first year. She said, you don't know how to have a relationship. And she said, if there's anybody here that would have a relationship with you, he is sick and you need to leave him alone. She said, healthy people don't go out with sick people. There's nobody here that would go out with you if he's healthy. Stay away from him if he wants to go out with you. So if anybody wanted to go out with me that first year, I said, you are sick. Leave me alone. What's wrong with you? God. So I did it. I stayed away, you know, and I focused in on God and myself in a relationship. And after a while, I did get in a relationship and stayed in that relationship for a long time. And eventually, you know, that didn't work out. Failed relationships are hard. They're tough. But I survived. The best relationship I've had, though, is a relationship with God of my understanding, and a relationship with me, and the relationship with the women that I sponsor, because it's just absolutely remarkable. Absolutely remarkable and so rewarding. You know, I've had jobs that have fallen through, jobs that I really, really loved, but God has just taken care of me in those. You know, I was 8 years sober. I was diagnosed with terminal cancer. And I absolutely could not believe it. Started feeling kind of bad, went to the doctor, was diagnosed with this terminal cancer. And I can remember while leaving the doctor's office and saying, my God, cancer, why me? And I heard my sponsor's voice in the back of my head saying, why not you? You know, cancer is a human condition. It is not a spiritual one. And along the way, somebody asked me, they said, are you mad at God? And I thought, mad at God? Why on earth would I be mad at God? You see, I was so grateful that at 8 years sober, I no longer had some God on some throne somewhere saying, you know, Mickey's doing pretty good today. Let's flick a little cancer on her and see how she handles that. Because if I thought that cancer was this condition that God had put on me, or that God was testing me, or that God was punishing me, in any way, then God's my problem. And God can't be my problem and my solution at the same time. What is my choice to be? God doesn't do that to us. Cancer is a human condition. And my God, I smoked, I ate foul food, I breathed this air that humans have, you know, done God knows what to, and then we get cancer and we say, you know, why did God do this to me? It's kind of bizarre, isn't it? You know? I don't know why I got this cancer. It just happened. The doctor told me it was genetic because the kind of cancer I had was I was far too young to get. I had colorectal cancer. I was 38 when I was diagnosed with it. I was far too young to get it. I told him I got it from so many years of men blowing smoke up my ass, but... sounded good to me. And I had been given 8 months to a year to live. But I went to MD Anderson Hospital and I met a doctor there that said, you're not going to like what we're going to have to do, but I think I can save your life. And today, I didn't like what he was going to have to do. But today, I have a life worth living. And I was willing to do whatever we had to do to save my life. So we went. I was willing to go to any lengths. I surrendered to that cancer. And we went through it. And for 2 years, I was sick as a dog. But I'm telling you, today I don't have cancer. I don't have cancer. Thank you. And 8 years later, there's not been any trace. And I've done all kinds of things to do it. I went to Indian sweat lodges. I did hands-on healing. I did Reiki. I went to churches where people fell out on the floor, talked in tongues, had snakes in the air. I did prayer grams, prayer circles. I did eight herbs. I have crystals in my rooms. I have feathers. I have angels. I did you name it, I did it. Anytime anybody came by and said, I think this will help you, I was there. And I did whatever anybody suggested, anything. Because if you believed it would help, there was power in it. And there's power in whatever it is you believe, just like there's power in the lies you believe too. Pay attention to what it is you believe. A couple of things I want to share and then I'll close. I had this job that I was working really, really hard on. I had it for several years. I worked my way up the totem pole, and I was in administration, working very, very hard at Council on Alcoholism as a director and working in administration, married to this job. And I got laid off in January and was like, thank you, God, I got laid off. Was laid off for a couple of months, and then they wanted me to come back. And I made the decision to not go back because I wasn't having fun anymore. You know, it had gotten to where I was not doing my primary purpose. And didn't know what I was going to do. And so I talked to my mentors, I had talked to my peers, I had talked to my sponsor, and then I made the decision to not go back there. But I had a lot of fear. What was I going to do? The choices were limited in my field as to what I could do. So I didn't really know what I was going to do. So I put it in God's hands. And 2 days after I made the decision to not go back there, 2 days later I get a phone call. And this administrator said, we heard what has happened and we want you to come work for us. And I am now employed by Brazos County Adult Probation. It's just a hoot. I'm getting some of my money back now. I am the first convicted felon to be employed by Brazos County Adult Probation, and this is where I was on probation. So I am now in the computer and on the computer. And they created a position for me. I am part-time probation officer. I train probation officers, and I do some therapy with the offenders there. The offenders there is a group that I actually went through 15 years ago. And so it's just pretty ironic, the whole situation, how I've gone around full circle. I had to modify a defendant's order the other day, and it's probably the first 90 meetings in 90 days that has been signed by a judge since I was on probation way back when, but I got one modified and signed by a judge the other day. So those kind of orders are probably going to be coming out of Brazos County a little more regularly than they have in a long time. And it's just been, it's really wild. It's pretty cool. One other thing I want to share with you, too, is I get a lot of emails from people all over the country. I've been, you know, I really like this email. And I got an email not too long, it's been a year now, that an email came from a young lady named Kimberly, who lives in Sugar Land, Texas, which is right outside of Houston. And I got an email from Kimberly, and I answered that email. And, you know, when we think that we have gotten enough or that God, that we think we've gotten enough or that there's not going to be any more miracles for us or that, you know, maybe the miracles for us is over or whatever, just know and trust that God's goodness is infinite and that there's always going to be more and that there's more miracles always, that the pot is limitless. Kimberly emailed me, and I emailed her, and we talked by phone and email for a little while, and then I went and met her. And to make another long story real short is Kimberly and I have been working on a relationship now for the past year, and Kimberly is the daughter that I gave up for adoption 29 years ago. And isn't that cool? Again, I thank God I didn't get what I deserve. And it is a miracle that we have been reunited, and we're working on a relationship, and we're starting to become pretty good friends today. And that is something that, again, when I finally was able to let go of that and made those amends by leaving those people alone, God saw fit to put her in my life. And, it was because of some actions on her part. And, miracles keep happening. I expect them. I know that they will happen in all of our lives when God is ready, not when I'm ready. You know, I'm probably not what I should be. I'm probably not what I could be. But thank God I'm not what I used to be. Thank y'all for having me at your conference this weekend.